Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touchtone phone. And as a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. Well, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Dr. Messner, please go ahead.
Thank you, and thank you so much, Krista. And I want to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop. Today's workshop is titled New Perspectives in the Treatment of Advanced Skin Cancer, Advanced Basal Cell and Squamous Cell Cancer. The program is made possible by a grant from Genentech. And it's really my great pleasure now to introduce the speaker. And our first speaker, well, actually, before I do that, I just want to comment on just the fact that we have so many of you on the call today. We have over 150 participants on this call today. You come from all over the United States, from both urban, rural, and suburban communities. We also have international participants from Canada and the United Kingdom. I really want to welcome everyone to today's program. Today's program is supported by, as made possible, by a grant from Genentech, and I really want to thank them for their support of today's program. I would now like to introduce our first speaker, and our first speaker is Dr. Mario LaCouture, and Dr. LaCouture is chief of dermatology, NYU Langone Hospital, Long Island, medical director of the symptom management program at Perlmutter Cancer Center, and in Long Island, and professor of medicine. Department of Medicine at NYU Langone, Long Island, NYU Grossman, Long Island School of Medicine. And Dr. LaCouture will be addressing an overview of advanced skin cancers, including basal cell and squamous cell cancers, new treatment approaches, emerging role of targeted therapy, clinical trial updates, managing treatment side effects, and discomfort and pain, tips for caring for your skin during cancer treatments, sun and wind safety tips, and communicating with your healthcare team about quality of life concerns. It's now my great pleasure now to introduce you and to bring on, and I'm going to turn this program now over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. LaCouture.
Thank you so much, Caroline. It's always a great pleasure to be here, and it's always wonderful to be able to discuss with so many wonderful people in the audience the advances that have taken place in the treatment of advanced skin cancers, including basal cell cancers and squamous cell cancers. So let's begin by first speaking about what these cancers look like and how often they happen. So it's important to remember that these are the most common cancers in humans. So there are millions of cases in the United States and all over the world every year, and they usually appear after the fourth to fifth decade in most people, and they occur in areas that are exposed to the sun, usually, so face, chest, upper back, and arms. And they present as little bumps that are very shiny for basal cell cancers, or little spots like the size of a, of a dime that look red and flaky and white. They have little white flakes. They may or may not be itchy. Usually they're not itchy. But one thing that is indicative of this being a cancer is if they start bleeding without being scratched. So keep an eye out for those spots that bleed without being scratched. So despite there being such negative effects of cancers, the good news is that there are a lot of good treatments for this, both when they are early or small, or even when they are advanced, there are treatments for them now. We didn't have these things 10, 20 years ago. In terms of how we approach these, well, if they are small, if it's early, what you can do is usually treat them with a small surgical procedure where you go to a dermatologist's office and the same day it's done. Or they can be treated with other ways such as topical or creams. Certain creams have been approved to treat these when it's very early. Now, when they are what we call advanced, in other words, they become large and grow deep into the skin or may invade even other organs, the approach to treatment changes, because it usually will involve a radiation oncologist, will involve a surgeon, and also a medical oncologist. These different types of physicians or providers will work together to give you the best treatment possible. We do know today that the amazing advances that have occurred in cancer are a result of the combination of treatments, combining surgery with radiation, with medications in advanced cancers when indicated, usually gives you the best outcome. So what are these new treatments that have emerged? Because surgery, at least for skin cancers, has remained a great modality to treat them for the past 50 years, as has radiation. Where there have been the most dramatic changes has been in the introduction of new types of medications. Because the new types of medications for these advanced skin cancers, basal and squamous cell cancers, are what we call targeted therapies. Targeted therapies indicate that, as opposed to conventional chemotherapy, we are now able to block very specific parts of the cell that are responsible for those cancers. Now, that doesn't mean that the medications will not have side effects of their own, but it indicates that we know what are the specific triggers for cells to become cancerous, and we can attack them more effectively. So for basal cell cancers, the past 10 years, there have been two drugs that have been approved, vismodegib and sonidegib. They have very interesting names. And these drugs block a protein in basal cell cancers that inhibit their growth. These little molecules that are responsible for these cancers function together sequence. Therefore, they form what is called a pathway that activates or that is involved in the cancer. So blocking these pathways is what results in the benefit. In particular, in this one, the pathway is called the hedgehog pathway. So these drugs are taken orally usually, and they are taken daily, and they result in benefit in a lot of people, maintaining their condition stable or even reducing it, and giving people back their ability to conduct their daily hobbies and life. But for squamous cell cancers, it's a little bit different, because the types of drugs that are used are known as epidermal growth factor receptor inhibitors. I know it's a mouthful, it's a law, but what the name just means is that the medications block the growth of skin cells. And by blocking the growth of skin cells, what happens is that not only they can attack the squamous cell cancers, but also they will result in side effects affecting the skin. A side effect that looks like an acne-type rash, but it's not acne. We'll go in a few minutes, we'll talk about how to manage all these side effects. So now, what are the potential benefits, of course, of using these drugs are known. They can reduce the size of the cancer. They can eliminate it to a degree in some cases. But still, they need to be taken indefinitely, right? So what side effects should we expect? Well, with the first class of drugs that is approved for the basal cell cancers, the side effects with these drugs include hair loss. So just because a drug is targeted and just because a drug is given as a pill doesn't mean that it's not going to cause hair loss. They do cause hair loss. They can cause very dry skin. They can cause also very interesting side effect that we were not expecting, which is muscle cramps. There are some medications that can be taken for this. And another very peculiar side effect from these drugs is that they can cause a lot of weight loss. They do cause changes in the way that food tastes, but this weight loss appears to be independent of that. So it's important to keep that in mind and to perhaps speak with a nutritionist or a dietitian to find a good menu or things that you may want to change in your diet before you start these drugs. Interestingly, people say there are certain recommendations. People say that things that they are better tolerate are very spicy foods, the foods that are not very hot, and the use of plastic silverware instead of really metallic silverware because of the taste. Also, the taste of water, it may not be very pleasant, so people, it's encouraged for people to drink juices. So that's one thing. But again, speaking with your doctor, it's good to come up with a plan for that. Now, for the muscle cramps, medications prescribed by your doctor can be taken. And then another thing that has emerged in the past few years because of all these side effects is that perhaps giving the drugs in an intermittent way, so for a certain period of time, stopping and then for giving it, putting it back in, may be a way to go in order for people to tolerate those side effects. So it's important to discuss with your provider what the best way would be for you, because we don't know, we can't predict who will develop side effects and who will not. Now, the important thing now about using these drugs is that they need to be taken as long as they are working. So medical oncologists are really wonderful at not only finding what the best medication is, but also helping you cope with side effects. So let's move on to the medications for the squamous cell cancer. So these targeted therapies block that very long word that we can also summarize as EGFR. So these drugs cause that acne-type rash. They can cause diarrhea as well. Thankfully, there are many, many interventions we can use to prevent these side effects, in the form of topical medications, so creams, lotions, as well as antibiotic pills taken by mouth. These decrease the severity of these side effects by more than 50%. So my suggestion would be, if you're going to start some of these drugs, to discuss with your oncologist really what the best medication is to prevent the side effects, and discuss with your doctor what is the best way to prevent that. And they will give you prescriptions. The nurses will also facilitate that. And maybe setting up a few calls within the first month to see if there are any side effects that you can prevent, because most side effects appear during the first month. It is very important that you communicate side effects with your doctor and your oncologist team. Some people think, and I understand why, that the more they talk about their side effects, they may be taken off. But no, we now have many tools for side effects, so it's not going to be a problem. And it's better to know when they're early rather than when it's late and they're very severe. So in terms of the diarrhea, also there's medications for that, and changing the diet may be helpful. I also want to point out that, again, in the past decade or so, a new class of drugs called immunotherapies that activate the immune system have been introduced. And there's another wonderful program by Cancer Care that is focused on this, but I think it's important to mention it anyway. So these drugs activate the immune system, and basically your immune system is this whole army of cells you have inside your body and skin and tissues that are meant to protect you against infections. Well, now scientists have found a way to activate these cells or to turn them on so that they go and attack. Thankfully, most of the time they see cancer cells as being the cells that they should be attacking. But in some cases, they see normal cells as well. And when they see those normal cells, they can cause side effects too. So it's important to keep that balance in mind when choosing these medications. These immunotherapies are usually given intravenously or through a shot in the arm or in the vein or a port. But your oncologist will know what is the best treatment option for you based on where the condition is located and how long it's been there and other factors in your health. Now, another comment that I would like to speak about is radiation. Radiation is such an important component for the treatment of skin cancers. It's widely used, even when it's combined with targeted therapies or immunotherapies. So keep in mind that radiation is very important, and it may be used in combination. Most of the side effects of radiation, of course, include the effects in the parts of the body that are in between the cancer and the radiation. So the skin comes again. So what do you see in skin? Well, after several weeks of treatment, what you see is that the skin can become sensitive, red, tender. If it's in the head and you have hair in that area, the hair will start shedding. So keep that in mind when you are receiving radiation, because there are things that can be done to prevent this from affecting your life. So, for example, we can use topical anti-inflammatory steroids and creams. We can use antibiotics as well, topically, in other words, creams prescribed by a doctor or their medical oncologist or radiation oncologist to prevent and treat these problems. Also, there is some evidence that taking anti-inflammatory medications by mouth is beneficial in reducing the symptoms of pain and tenderness in these areas. Okay, so we've talked about the different types of treatments, and these treatments, again, this is changing constantly. So it's important to discuss with your medical oncology team what new therapies there are, because clinical trials are ongoing all the time with new treatments. So once the treatment has been completed, what are key recommendations so that this doesn't happen again? Well, sun protection is key, although most people already had most of their sun exposure when they were younger, right? What we didn't know about the effects of sun exposure on the development of skin cancers. That said, we do have the obligation to try to prevent these in the future, because, as we all know, it's not a very pleasant although they can be cured or treated in many cases, it's still something you don't want to have to go through again. So what can we do to prevent these? Well, sun protection, so using a sunscreen that has a sun protection factor of at least 15 applied every 2 hours, very generously over the skin. And what probably is most effective, because most people apply sunscreens inappropriately, including myself, we don't apply enough of it. We don't apply it frequently enough. So sun protective clothing, so broad-brimmed hats, long shirts that, and with materials that you can get these very inexpensively these days that have sun protection in them. So sun protective clothing. And also keeping in mind that the sun exposure can go through window glass of your car. resulting in these negative effects. Okay, so what else can we talk about relating to these drugs? Because one of the main side effects also is that they leave the skin very dry. So for skin dryness, please keep your showers or baths short. Don't use very hot water. Fragrance-free detergents and soaps are also important. Interestingly, something that has really emerged in the past, I would say 5 years or so, is the use of a vitamin to prevent skin cancers. Who would have thought that this would be possible? Well, it turns out that there was a study that was published several years ago that the use of a vitamin, niacinamide, 500 milligrams twice daily, reduced the frequency of new skin cancers in people who were taking them. So this is something that is usually, you can prescribe this, and people, usually it's something that can also be in, encountered in pharmacies. So it's usually, this is a form of vitamin B3. So 500 milligrams twice a daily as a supplement or as a prescription from your doctor. So these, all of these efforts that obviously require a lot of participation from the amazing people that have to really work with the medical oncology, the radiation oncology team, as well as the surgical oncologist, are important to keep in mind and to remember that these are very common. They, not only are they, these types of skin cancers very common, side effects are common. So you are not alone. Your medical oncology team is there for you. And so is cancer care. So please reach out any time that you have any questions or doubts, because you are the reason why we do what we do every day. And we want to help, and we want to be there for you. And we hope that programs such as these are helpful. And there is never too much support, in my opinion. So thank you again. I appreciate your time today. And please be well and stay safe. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Lakatour. That was a wonderful presentation and really provided everybody with so much information in terms of the treatment of advanced basal cell and squamous cell cancers. And now we're going to move on to our next speaker. And our next speaker is Dr. Fleischman. And Dr. Fleischman will be addressing the increasing role of telehealth, telemedicine appointments, guidelines to prepare for telehealth, telemedicine appointments, including technology, prepared list of questions, and follow-up appointments. It's now my pleasure to bring on our next speaker, Dr. Stuart Fleischman.
Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining on to the call, and thank you to all the participants in the call for their interest in learning about skin cancers and cancer's effect on the skin. I'm here to discuss a little bit about quality of life concerns and the need to communicate with your oncology treatment team. We don't always think of skin as such an important organ, but skin is probably the biggest organ we have, and it's the most visible to people. So it is important for a number of reasons. In addition to the physiologic reasons, it's something that people see and something that may identify that we're not feeling well. So it's important that your skin be discussed with your oncology team to make sure that everything is okay. And if you have concerns, please be sure to bring them up. In the post-COVID pandemic world, we've learned that a lot of care now is given online, and that may be an increased number of phone calls, audio, regular old-fashioned telephone calls, or actually calls that have a video component through a telehealth system or through a video chat system, depending upon who your providers are, where you live, what's available, and the laws that govern these sorts of things. But telehealth is something that we've adopted very quickly and have had to learn how to use very quickly. And many practices still do some or part of the work on a telehealth call. So there are certain things that you need to remember to do. If your provider will be calling you or you'll be calling in for telehealth, you need to make sure the time is set, if you're crossing time zones, what time zone you need to be thinking in. Make sure that you have a quiet place to have the telehealth visit. Make sure that the device that you're using is fully charged. It would be terrible if the telephone or tablet or computer or even regular telephone lost its power during your visit, because that time is valuable to everybody. So it's a good idea to think about these things in ahead, and charging your device is really very helpful to do beforehand. Once you know the time and that's all set, you need to find out if the provider's office will be calling you or you will be calling them. Some of these connections are made through an online platform or an online app, and if it's your first time, they will instruct you, and often they will actually do a sort of a dress rehearsal call just to make sure that you can connect. One of the unexpected advantages of telehealth calls is that if you have a relative or a friend who you want to be involved in your care, previously, before the pandemic and before we were accessing the telehealth, they would have to actually travel to the city you're in or the place you're in and meet you at the cancer center and participate in the visit. Now they can be anywhere as long as your provider's office and you agree that they should be on the call, and they can participate in the call in a very meaningful way. They can actually help you ask questions or make sure that you're asking the questions you have. They may have questions on their own if you want them to ask that, or the information that the provider will give you. Sometimes there's a lot of information, and they can help take notes and help remind you of that information later on. So this is a sort of an unintended consequence that actually has benefited us, and we didn't anticipate before the isolation of that COVID brought into our lives. Having questions prepared in advance is very helpful because that way the visit is well organized and you get your questions answered. And I bet the providers will also have questions for you, and it's a good idea that they organize themselves too. And most of us have gotten a lot better with this. Because the skin is so visible, it may be that if you have something on your skin that needs attention, you may, your provider may ask to see it. If you're on a video call or if you have taken photos of it, that photo somehow gets transmitted to the provider's office in a confidential and private way. You wouldn't want that photo just going anywhere. And this is different than an internal organ, obviously, that you couldn't produce an image of on a call. But that may be possible. It may not be enough. There may not be enough clarity to really see exactly what it is, or depth. Colors may change, but it's something that may be possible at least at for the start. So, again, more unintended advantages of telehealth calls that we didn't anticipate before a COVID pandemic. The other important thing that happened over the last few years, and as a result of the information portability and privacy laws that are in the United States, is that much of the charting that is done by your providers goes into a large database, and that database often has an area where patients can enter, called a patient portal. There are a number of large companies that have these throughout the country and are used in many parts of the world as well. The unusual thing that can happen is that if your provider orders lab tests or x-rays or any kind of imaging studies or even the pathology reports, those can show up on your portal before your provider has had a chance to look at it. Reading these can be very tricky, very difficult. Even people in other subspecialties of medicine who don't read these things all the time may have some trouble interpreting them. So it is important, if you read these, especially before your provider discusses them with you, not to panic, to actually make a call to your provider's office or make a request online and make sure that somebody from the provider's office can actually go over them with you, especially when it comes to reports, because it can just be very misleading. There's a lot of jargon in these reports, and not everybody is really fluent in what all these things mean. Many patients can sometimes look at lab results and see that some of the results are abnormal or outside of the normal range and get very frightened. But often during cancer treatment, some of those values are supposed to be abnormal. So it is really important to have somebody help you and guide you through and explain why things are the way they are, as well as if anything needs attention or follow-up testing. So it's really important to be able to go over these reports with somebody who understands oncology and understands your situation to make it meaningful and to avoid a lot of unnecessary worry, because it's just very hard to understand these details. So that's a recap of a number of topics that Dr. Messner has asked me to review today. And at this point, I'll turn the call back to Dr. Messner.
Thank you so much, Dr. Fleischman. That was an excellent presentation, very comprehensive as well. And so I very much appreciate that. And between Dr. Fleischman and Dr. Couture, we surely have quite a bit of information for everybody today. And now we're going to take questions from all of you on the call today in just a moment. For those of you who are on the call now, I'm going to take questions from the Q&A. And so we have a number of questions from the participants today, so I'm going to ask all of you to queue up and ask your questions. I'm going to also ask all of you to, Krista to review with everybody how to queue up for questions. And
thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
Another question actually for Dr. LaCouture. I'm a 1.5 year past treatment for small cell cancer. For my MLH1 Lynch syndrome mutation, I had cutaneous CC removed from nearby in my right buttock in a Mohs procedure 10 years prior to diagnosis. Although all my physicians deny there is any relationship between the two, I am not convinced not convinced genomic testing was atypical for anal or colorectal cancers. Dr. LaCouture, could you comment on that?
Yes. So, it's very important what has been mentioned just now, because there could be a situation here where there is additional information which in some cases does not contribute to the overall treatment, because we may not have medications to treat those certain mutations. So just for the rest of the audience, thank you for bringing that question. I'm sure it wasn't easy to ask that, and certainly hasn't been easy what you have been going through. So I really have to say that I learned so much from people like you that have the courage to to continue to ask these questions, very difficult questions. I'm afraid that it's something that would require what we call tumor board discussion, in which several different specialists come together to discuss what would be the best treatment approach based on the location, the size, and, as you indicated, the mutation. Now, if we are talking about specific mutations, it's important to know that cancer has changed. Cancer treatment has changed so much that in some situations, what we know now is that irrespective of where the cancer originates from, we will treat it based on the mutation. So keep that in mind in the future, and consult with your medical oncologist, because there could be clinical trials or medications that can treat the cancer. Just to give you an example, last week the FDA approved a medication that targets a protein in cancers called HER2, and it was approved to treat cancers that have this protein anywhere in the body, which is really a remarkable thing. So, interdisciplinary discussion in your case, comprised of medical oncologists, radiation oncologists, and surgical oncologists, would be my recommendation.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you so much. It's a wonderful question, and thank you so much, Dr. Lakator, for answering this in such a remarkable way, and so helpful both. Another question is about sunscreen. So what type of sunscreen should people be using in terms of what type of sunscreen do you recommend as a dermatologist?
Yes, great question. What type of sunscreen? So I would say the best type of sunscreen to use is the one that you feel you would continue to use, because most people do not apply, including myself, do not apply enough sunscreen and do not apply it frequently enough. In order for sunscreen to really protect you, you need to apply every 2 hours or every hour of swimming or sweating an amount equivalent to 1 ounce, or what would be in a small shot glass, for example, or espresso cup. So that's a lot. That's a lot of sunscreen to keep applying. So most people don't do that. However, if you are the kind of person, and I really commend you for that, that does that, would recommend a sunscreen that has, look for one of two ingredients in it, zinc or titanium. Why? Because these are what we call the physical blockers. In other words, they are millions of these tiny little particles that reflect all of the sun's rays from your skin. The good thing is that they also are not absorbed by your body. They're non-toxic, and they tend to be a little bit more difficult to spread out because they're a little bit thicker, and they're like in a white cream, but they provide the best protection. Now, what can we say about sun protective clothing? Well, I think there's a lot to be said, because sun protective clothing, in my opinion, can be even more effective, because you don't have to keep applying it, because you just wear it. Same for a hat. So the combination of both is better, of course, but if you had to choose one, I would say it depends. If the area is completely covered, I would say the clothing, because, again, it keeps it, it stays there. So sun protective clothing, a broad-brimmed hat, sunglasses. Also, keeping in mind that some of the sun's rays can go through window glass. So keeping those things in mind, using it frequently enough, are key. If for small areas like the face, you could use one of the other sunscreens that is lighter and easier to apply, that usually come in very clear liquids, for example. Those can be used as well on the face. But again, frequent use and abundant use is key.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you so much. And then there's a question, again, for Dr. Lakator. What is the difference between actinic keratosis and Bowen disease? are they treated differently?
Yes, great question. So the question is about these names. In dermatology, we give these very interesting names to certain skin conditions. So one of them is actinic keratosis, and the name is derived from sun, from actinic, and then keratosis because there's a protein we make in our skin called keratin, and these spots look like these very these little flaky red spots. Bowen's disease, of course, has the name of someone, and what it indicates is that now, whereas the actinic keratosis is a type of skin cancer, or we call it pre-cancer, it may become cancer because it does not involve the entire thickness of the outer layer of the skin. It is less than the entire thickness. Bowen's disease, on the other hand, it is the full thickness. So that can have different implications for therapy because the former actinic keratosis can be treated easily with just a cream or the use of liquid nitrogen, for example, which is this spray that is applied on the area of cold liquid or the cream. And Bowen's disease may need a small surgical procedure. The best person to treat this is a dermatologist. In particular, there are certain dermatologists that are focused only on treating skin cancers. And when it's in areas of the face or other hands, for example, they can employ a type of procedure called Mohs surgery, after the name of Dr. Frederick Mohs, who invented this procedure, which basically implies that you remove the least amount of skin while ensuring that all the cancer is out. So there is a difference between both. Depending on the size, likely that actinic keratosis is treated with a small procedure with cryotherapy, we call it, for cold or a cream, and the latter may require surgery.
Thank you so much. And the next question for you, Dr. Mercatore, is there a relationship between viruses like HPV and skin cancer? Can having HPV increase risk?
Ah, interesting. Wonderful question, by the way. Yes, I think people have been reading a lot. It's interesting. So one of the things that is so fascinating is that we now know that there are certain germs that can cause cancer. Who would have thought this before, that cancer is actually a disease that could be triggered or caused by germs? Well, this was discovered almost 100 years ago when a scientist found that this could happen actually in chickens. But since then, we've evolved a lot, of course, the knowledge. We now have vaccines that prevent cancer, that vaccines for this HPV, human papillomavirus infection. So the question is whether HPV is involved in these skin cancers, squamous cell carcinomas in particular. And the answer is, it is involved in some types of squamous cell carcinoma, not in all. We do know that HPV 16 in women in the cervix predisposes to cervical cancer, which is a type of squamous cell cancer. In the external skin, in some cases, if you were to look for HPV, it would be there, but it appears that the virus is important for the initial stages of the cancer, not later on. In other words, once the person has a cancer, even if it is or is not caused by HPV, removing the HPV will not get rid of the cancer. You have to cure the cancer because the HPV was mostly the initiating factor. So if you have HPV is very, very common. HPV exposure, most people have been exposed to HPV when they're adults. That's why the HPV vaccine is recommended for all adults up until the age of 45. Everyone until the age of 45. So most people will be exposed. So I don't think that then if everyone is exposed, that then this would be related whether there's a higher risk. The point is that if the question is also relating to the vaccination, I think it is important to vaccinate, and we have seen cases where the vaccination improves people's other sites of viral infection with warts, like in the hands or in other parts of the body? So good question. It may be associated with HPV of the genital area or other HPVs. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Lakatori. You're really amazing. And these are amazing questions that people are asking,
yes.
And you are giving amazing.
Yeah.
And the next question is, does having freckles increase the risk of skin cancer?
Having freckles?
Yes, having freckles.
Oh, okay, freckles. So having freckles by itself doesn't increase the risk of skin cancer. Having freckles is more of a genetic, it's a genetic predisposition, and it may be associated with sun exposure. Certain lesions called lentigos are associated with sun exposure, so the more sun exposure you have, yes. But freckles as an independent, so like just the fact of having freckles does not place you at higher risk for skin cancer. However, if you have light skin, fair-colored skin, then that places you at a higher risk for skin cancer. So it's important to protect yourself from sun exposure because that's the other factor. Now, speaking about sun exposure, one thing would like to mention that if one way to encourage people to protect themselves against the sun, it's not always, in my opinion, to say that it's going to lead to the formation of cancer, but also because it's hard to change people's behavior, but also to remind people that nothing ages your skin as much as sun exposure. Wrinkles, discoloration of the skin, saggy skin on your face, and brown spots and discoloration, white spots even, all a result of sun exposure. So for those of you that are trying to convince a member in your family to stop getting so much sun or to protect themselves against the sun, remind them that not only the skin cancer risk, but also the risk for aging.
Excellent. Thank you. And the next question is really having to do with is it possible for basal cell cancers to spread to different tissues?
Yes. So basal cell cancers are the most common type. So about 2 million cases every year in the United States. They are the most benign as well, but unfortunately they can spread. The rate of spread, the ability of them to spread to other organs in the body, first of all, they would spread to neighboring organs. So if they're on the, let's say, in the scalp or in the face, they can go on the nose, inside the nose, right? But they rarely spread to distant organs, very, very rarely, probably less than 1,000 cases. Really spread to distant organs, 1 to 2,000 cases a year of this. So it is very rare, but this is precisely why we want to treat these early on. I was reading an article the other day of something. They analyzed people that were suspected of having cancer, and up to a third to 40% of people would not return to the doctor even after they suspected it because they were understandably. It's completely understandable. They were afraid of what would happen next, right? With skin cancers, there are many treatments when they're early. So I encourage you, if you suspect you have a skin cancer, go to your doctor because it is likely that that you will have some type of treatment available.
Excellent. And we just have actually one more question for reconstruction. What is the difference between a skin graft and a skin flap?
Great question. So people here have a lot of experience with these, which is good. The more informed people are, the better. So in terms of a skin graft or a skin flap, the skin graft is when skin is taken from another part of the body, a distant, like the leg, and a flap is when the same skin in the area is just shifted or moved around, and it's kept in the area to cover a hole or a defect in the skin.
Excellent. And I just want to remind everyone that we do have a part two of this program, which will be taking place on May 14th, Emerging Treatments for metastatic melanoma. So you'll be getting reminders of that, but I just want to remind everybody that we will be having another program on melanoma as well on May 14th. And then I just also would like to provide everyone with takeaways from today's program. Also, I think an important takeaway is that basically it's important to for everyone to really see the dermatologist regularly and to be able to, be comfortable with the fact that dermatologists are just amazing people and that they provide such important service to all of you and that that's such an important part of our programs today and what we're trying to have people do actually in terms of the programming is that to really keep everyone as informed as possible because it really is important that you get the very best care possible and of course that's what we're all aiming for is that you would all get the very best care possible. And I would just like to say a few words about the program today. First of all, we do want to thank all of you for being so very well informed and so very interested in the program today. That's really what's so important. And I also want to thank all of you for asking really such great questions. And I do want to remind everybody that today's program, is an important one, and yet it's a very important one, and that there will be another part to this program, that will be a part two to this program. And that's probably just incredibly important for all of you to keep this in mind. And so, again, I would like to just thank everybody for your participation today. And I want to remind all of you that that you are not alone in coping with a basal cell cancer, that you are now part of Acunia Support, and that we are here to help you. And that both Cancer Care is here to help you, and that also your healthcare team is, of course, here to help you as well. And that's really most important that you understand that we are all here to be here for you for these programs. I just would like to just stress how very important it is that you're all. Such an important part of this program today. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.